We're in the life of Joseph together, and Joseph is, as we're starts chapter 37 or so, is when he was sold into captivity. And just remembering some of the kind of review pictures, Joseph had the coat of many colors. His brothers were jealous of his father's favoritism, but also his dreams. They sold him into slavery to the Midianites or the Ishmaelites. They kind of go by both names, who brought him to Egypt, where he was purchased by Potiphar. Joseph's on the right, and the fancy-looking man on the left would probably be Potiphar, who was a captain, or you could even translate that prince. Though I don't think he was royalty, but a high-level officer over the Pharaoh's guard. And again, the word guard there is an unusual word. For guard, it literally means slaughterers. So they were probably a very powerful and elite force, probably very close. Kind of reminds me of Caesar's Praetorian Guard, the ones close, near, and powerful in influence. So Potiphar is a very significant man. And he has purchased Joseph.
We see in the background there's someone noticing, but she comes up later. Joseph worked hard in every task that was given him. And so here we see him, whether it's the most humble or common task, he was pushing the mill or whatever this might be that he was working. But his very integrity and character and even joy, conversation about the Lord, his labors stood out. And Potiphar decided to kind of promote him, put him in charge of the household servants and those working outside the fields. So Joseph was such a good worker, and also not even just a good worker of good character and of good conduct and conversation, but even Potiphar, we're told, to me it's a remarkable statement. He saw that Yahweh was with him. So he recognized divine blessing, and he gave the glory to the God, the one true God, the God of Joseph and Isaac and Abraham and Jacob. And so here we see Potiphar is kind of watching, and Joseph is now working in an administrative capacity. Before long, he was doing everything. In fact, absolutely nothing. You know, it says that everything in the whole household was given over to Joseph, except for one thing. What was the one thing?
His
food. The food that was set before him was the one thing it says that he didn't, you know. In other words, all he did is all Potiphar did, you always got to watch him swap a name. All Potiphar did was he just eat the food set before him. Everything else, he gave no attention to anything. And the beauty of it was sometimes you hand over a responsibility to someone and you watch it, you know, nosedive and you think, oh, no, what have I done? And he's never done so well. Every area of responsibility he hands over goes through the roof successfully. And so Potiphar's saying, I'm not touching a thing. And he recognizes it's not just he's smart. God is blessing him. And so he is happy to have a channel of blessing. And again, that really reminds us of Romans 12. Those whom you bless, I will bless. Those whom you curse, I will curse. And so God's blessing is coming. It reminds me of the... we see that happening, remember, in the Ark in the Old Testament later on when David is moving the Ark, for example, and he parks it at a home. That home just expounds with blessing. God's showing his presence. And so there he is. Again, you see his leadership. He's got he's working with papers and documents. And so that's kind of where that begins. How long was he there in all this? If you follow through some of the text, when he went into Egypt, he's about 17 years old. When he stands before Potiphar, he's about before Pharaoh, he's about 30 years old. So he's, it didn't happen overnight. Sometimes we think, I've been working here 2 weeks. Why hasn't anyone seen my brilliance? It takes time. And a wise supervisor is going to watch over time. Well,
And we also notice then that it says that Potiphar's wife also took notice of him. And here's kind of the, are you familiar with the Young's literal translation? How many have heard that translation, the Young's literal translation? Okay, some of you are, you know, digitally, you know, you lose Bibles and all that. I guess I've seen it in print, but you see it readily available. It's one of those free Bible translations that's out there. Young is the same one who did a Young's Analytical Concordance. From, you know, if you've ever seen that older volume, he's very good with this, and this translation is helpful. He doesn't present it as the best reading translation. He tries to be kind of almost woodenly literal, and usually does a very good job, whether Greek or Hebrew, of reflecting the original text behind the text. And so he translates it this way, and and I'm going to translate him a little bit for our more modern ears. And it came to pass after these things that the Lord's, the Master's, but the word Lord, not the same word as Yahweh, but Adonai, his Lord's wife lifted up her eyes unto Joseph. You know, different translations kind of put that way, but that's the literally. It lifted her eyes onto Joseph. So she noticed him. So what do you notice about her noticing him? Yes, Julia.
It kind of reminds me of, like, you talked about with Judah, how he saw it's the first step of sin, I guess, and Adam and Eve, they saw the fruit and they took it.
You see that pattern again and again. The looking can often, and that's, what does that mean? So we should wear a mask over our eyes so we don't see anything. But rather, just sometimes we allow just the physical things, the outward experience. Oh, that's a good-looking fruit. That's a good-looking person. Whatever it might be, that can be often a very surfacey perception. And yet, the eye gate, we often call that, is often a source of temptation. Something looks attractive to us. You go to the grocery store, they know how to put certain items, the sweets and all that, whatever it might be, the magazines, whatever they're trying to push, the eye level is prime real estate in a grocery store, because the eye catches your attention. And when you get these catalogs, usually they're loaded with pictures, right? Because, you know, the eye gate can be a source of temptation. I'm not saying we don't use our eyes, but the idea is, I think, typical of temptation, making a judgment simply on what looks good as opposed to what is morally right and pleasing to the Lord. So there's more to what we see than what we see. But she looked at Joseph, and we saw in the previous verse that he was attractive in face and form. So he was bright. He was hardworking. He was a man of character. He was attractive. It doesn't say Pharaoh's wife noticed his great character, or his hard work ethic, or the Lord being with him and blessing him as her husband noticed. She just noticed his appearances. So here's just a warning. Too often people will look at someone and be attracted strictly on appearance, when there's a lot more to a person. And that's where in Proverbs 31, you know, beauty and charm are deceitful because they can pass with time. Character is deep. And so can we look beyond that and see what kind of character this person has? And again, especially, you know, when you're looking at friends, when you're thinking about a potential wife mate, don't stop at the external. Look deep. What's their heart like? Well, that wasn't how Pharaoh. Am I calling her Pharaoh's wife? Potiphar's wife. Watch me, okay? And you have to kind of put on your translation gear here. So, she suggested sin. Let's be sinful here. And his response was to be horrified. And so his response to her temptation was, there is no one greater in this house than I. Now, is that boasting? It's just a statement of fact. Nor has he kept her master, kept back anything from me but you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this wickedness and sin against him, sin against God? So what do you notice when he's answering her encouragement to sin? How does he answer that? What do you notice in his reasoning?
He's definitely not lustful.
Okay, he's not lustful. Yes, sir.
Yeah, he's talking about how great his master is and all that, but then in the end he's concerned about sinning against God.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's both. In one sense, he says, you know, this would be such a betrayal of someone who's put so much trust in me. And so one thing when we think of about this kind of sin is that a betrayal of a marriage covenant, the betrayal of a marriage commitment is such a betrayal on a human level. But then he says, and it would be a great wickedness. How could I sin against God? So he sees it, you know, he puts it to her in both ways. It's wrong on a human level. And where's God's thinking about that? Notice he doesn't say a word about the eye gate, about what looks or doesn't look pleasing. He's talking about what's right. And that so often is something people neglect. Last week, my days are swimming together. Yes, it was last week. I was asked to give an opening prayer for the city council here in Terrell. And as part of that prayer, I quoted the passage in Proverbs that says, righteousness exalts a nation. And someone came up to me afterwards, during this break time, they went into executive session. And they said, I so appreciated you saying that, especially that about righteousness. That's so important. And we had a little conversation right there, and he worked for the city, that if we're guided by righteousness, everything else tends to fall into place. What's the right thing to do? What is the righteousness, call of righteousness here? I told you a story. I worked for a summer painting at Dallas Seminary, and it was my summer job. And so I got on the painting crew. And so we were in there, and we were like in the dorm, which was the least valuable painting. And so you wouldn't see me painting in the president's office. So, but we were in there painting, and the head of the crew told a story of a guy who was, I think, maybe a painter himself, a house painter. And he kept hearing this on the radio. Come to this church, and we will do the good. We will do the good. And he thought, what a great motto. That, you know, church will help you do the good. He went and visited church, and they found out what they were saying is, we will do the good. It'll be good for you. But he developed this whole work ethic of do the good. And so whenever, so they taught us, the crew chief was telling us, sometimes you ask the question, well, are we supposed to remove the plates when we're painting? Do the good. What's the good thing to do? What's the right thing to do? You know, really, that's a simple standard, but Joseph was saying, what is the righteous thing to do? What would please the Lord? You know, so often, if we would just ask that question, that's what younger people might say, what would my parents want me to do? But all of us can ask, what would the Lord want me to do? And if we're honest with ourselves, that's all we need to know. And so notice Joseph's character. I want to please the Lord. And you're talking about what would not please the Lord. And so what's his response? Isn't that a great picture? Oh, wait a minute, he's running away. He's running away. Is that a cowardly thing to do?
It's the right thing to do.
Is there any kind of a biblical support for that response?
Yeah.
Flee youthful lust. You know, sometimes, you know, we are to stand against Satan, but at the same time, we're to flee temptation. And some, you know, like, you know, as you know, Jesus said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Sometimes the best thing we can do is get away from a situation. Avoid temptation. Walk away from it. You know, there were some people that will recognize, I go to certain parts of towns, I walk by a certain store, and next thing you know, I'm having struggles again. So what do? Avoid that neighborhood, avoid that store, avoid that street. And so here, he's getting out of there. It's a courageous thing to run from sin. Don't dally it. Don't debate it. Don't discuss it. Get out of town. Now, there's something about Potiphar. By the way, what's the name of Potiphar's wife? We don't know. Potiphar's, Mrs. Potiphar. We don't know her name, do we? But is there anything about, when you look back there and see her, is there anything you notice?
She's got his coat.
She has his coat. And so when she was persuading, she had a hold of his garment, and he took off, and okay, so she's got the garment. I'm getting out of here. Sometimes there are young people, you may be in a situation where friends are going to tell you something like, hey, let's do this. Hey, we're going to go over here and do that. And the very best thing you can do is get away. And that's what he did. Joseph is an example to us of how you deal with temptation. And sometimes you just got to put some distance between you and the temptation. Do not follow those who would lead you into sin. Psalm 1 talks about the blessings of those who do not walk in the counsel of the wicked. Do not sit in the seat of the scoffer. And so he's running. And so there she is again with the garment. Hey, wait. And there he goes. Well, Mr. Potiphar came home, and so she concocted a story. Instead of saying, he left us behind when I was encouraging him to sin, she said, you know, hey, this is evidence. He was encouraging me to sin. And you can see he got very angry because here's the evidence. But she was framing him. And there's a reminder to us the value of don't always assume that what people tell you is on the front, you know, I mean, do your research, ask questions. Well, this thing, though, about the garment struck me as reminds me of some other passages of Scripture. Remember, when Adam and Eve were guilty of sin, what did they do? They made garments out of fig leaves. And so we say that dealing with the issue of shame. Remember, the Lord replaced those garments with animal skins. But in particular, I'm also reminded of, remember, what's the story? What do you think's going on here? Jacob, he's getting, first of all, the animal skin, so he'll feel furry, like his brother. And also remember, they put on even his brother's own coat so he could smell like his brother. And so here was a garment that was used for deception. And so then here's another incident. Remember when the brothers came with a garment and deceived Jacob and said, hey, this looks familiar. Is this your son's garment? Yep, that's the coat of many colors, or the long sleeve garment. So, but what's interesting is in Joseph's life, here the coat seems to be an issue. It was a point of conflict with his brothers. It was a point of deception to his father. And here he is once again, where his coat is a point of deception and accusation. So So what happened to Joseph? They took him off to jail. You know, he argued his innocence, but who are you going to believe? The wife of Potiphar or a Hebrew slave? He's not even Egyptian. And so it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," and his anger was aroused. Joseph's master took him and put him into a prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. What's your reaction to that?
Life's not fair.
Life's not fair. This is unjust, isn't it? Once again, he's in a sense imprisoned. Once again, he's in chains. Once again, it's unjust. And yet, this is the one that God was with him, we're told. So first his brothers have betrayed him. Now he's falsely accused and in a prison. But we're verse 21 to 23. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. Remember, we saw that last time. The whole time he was being sold into slavery and going down to Joseph's, Potiphar's house in Egypt, the Lord was with him. You know, we often want to say, the Lord is with me. That means everything is going smoothly. The Lord is with him. He's a slave. He's imprisoned. He's betrayed. He's treated unjustly. He's falsely accused and falsely imprisoned. The Lord was with him. Our circumstances don't prove the Lord is with us. God's word proves the Lord is with us. And so the Lord gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. The keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority. Does that sound like anyone else we've heard of? I mean, similar situation. It's Potiphar all over again, isn't it? Because the Lord was with him. And whatever he do, the Lord made it prosper. But the Lord is with him in the hard times. Don't think if the Lord's with me, he'll take the hard times away from me. If the Lord is with me, he'll walk through the hard times with me. And he will give me the grace I need. And so, Hebrews quotes the scriptures, the Old Testament, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." It's a promise to God's people. He will not leave us. He will not forsake us. "Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world." So Jesus promised he would be with us, his people. And so we look to that, we count on that, we lean on that. And we seek to please him because he's with us. I've often mentioned about Psalm 23, it's really powerful. You know, it keeps talking about the Lord, he does this, he does this, he does that. Then when we talk about when I walk through the valley of shadow of death, you are with me. And so often in the most difficult and painful times, is when we can really count on the presence of the Lord. And I don't know, maybe that's where some of you are, some of you will be. Count on him being with you. Run from sin, walk with the Lord. How's that for? What do they talk about on Wednesday night? That about covers it. Run from sin and walk with the Lord, and the Lord is with him. And so once again we see, he's, I guess, given this, this must be the managing slaves collar. And next thing you know, he's out ministering to the various other prisoners and caring for them. What are some other takeaways from this portion of scripture, chapter 39 of Genesis?
We discourage the future by judging our present circumstances. We don't see the whole thing
Excellent. Some of us get so focused on the present, we're not even thinking about the future, and we don't, yeah, not to lose heart in the midst of it. Excellent.
He was always him. I mean, he was always what he knew to do. He did it.
Kind of reminds me of what I've heard in a couple of these sports movies, you know, play your game, play your game, you know, that's what he did. He didn't play God's game. He didn't become someone different before Potiphar or before the prison guard. He was Joseph. And he followed after the Lord. You know, have you ever maybe heard of people or seen people even that their circumstances change and they change? Not for the better. Isn't it wonderful when you can find someone? You know, that's something that I've enjoyed at funerals. You often hear about a person, everybody's kind of talking about them. I love when everybody that talks about them says basically the same thing. I knew him. He's my family member. He was my cousin, my brother, whatever. He was my supervisor. We went to school together. And everybody says the same thing about the person. I love that. They were who they were all the time. So having that kind of that's where Joseph was. He was just, his job was to please the Lord. And if that meant hard menial labor, or if that meant being a supervisor, he was still Joseph, and the Lord was with him. Good. Yes.
I think it's good to have a plan and think ahead of situations you may encounter and how you're going to respond to different stimuli or different situations. That way that whenever it does come along, you know, you're more of a natural response and you're not caught off guard.
Okay, so I don't know if you heard what Greg was saying there. Sometimes it's good to pre-plan your response for certain circumstances that may come up. A lot of times, some of us, something will come up and we kind of, and then that pause, we might have a problem. He pre-decided how he would respond. I've heard different ones talk, you know, people that are in intense job situations and police or military, and they talk about, you know, if you first thing in, I remember hearing a guy who had been a prisoner of war under the Germans and all that, and frequently escaped and was frequently captured, but you know, many years later, like 40, 50 years later, he was being interviewed in this documentary. He said, you know, I still, when I walk into the room, I start figuring out before anything else, where are all the exits? You know, he'd learn, you know, it was built into him, if something happens, how am I getting out of here? And, you know, on the airplane, I don't know if you've ever been on, you know, on the airplane when they get up and they start talking. Have you ever noticed how many people tune them out? They're telling you what to do if something important happens. And so I kind of like to know, where are the exits? And how does that door open? And who am I going to shove out of the way to make sure I know? Pre-deciding. Okay, what's the situation? That's excellent. So pre-deciding. If something's going on, and you especially, you know, things are going on, your friends are going in certain directions that you, if they suggest this, you pre-decide, what am I doing? And that might even be knowing how you're going to break loose and call your parents and say, come get me, or whatever it may be. Pre-deciding a course of action. That might be in the work world too, right? I told the story I heard about of a lady that was fired because she wouldn't lie when she wrote letters to the customers. Her employer wanted her to write letters and say, oh yeah, we've already shipped that, when they haven't. She said, I'm not going to lie. They fired her. And then they needed someone to be the cashier, and they called her back and hired her because now they wanted someone who would tell the truth all the time, how much money was in there. So, but she pre-decided, no, I can't lie. I'm not going to go there. Good. Pre-deciding. Excellent. This is another one of those chapters where it can be a little challenging to talk about. But I think it's vital to remind us that even when the Lord is with us, we may face strong temptations and opportunities to sin. And sometimes when the Lord is with us, what that means is we have to take flight and run from temptation and run from wrong. And what governed him was,
he wanted to please the Lord. That would be sinful. That would be wicked. I'm not going there. So may God give every one of us the courage to say, I'm going to do right. And I'll pay the consequences. Can you think of anyone else that went to prison for doing right?
Paul.
Yep. Many times. Of course,
John the Baptist.
And did he, was he, Paul often got out of prison. Peter was miraculously released, at least one time. John the Baptist didn't get out. The Lord Jesus Christ is the ultimate. And so doing right doesn't mean you won't suffer. Doing right means you'll please the Lord and he'll bless your labors. Okay.